Let's make it happen, Captain!
From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Gov Maharaj.
Welcome back to Defrag. All right, so let's get started today. We've got, first of all, you've got a clarification that you want to make on the read-only account question from last week.
Yeah, last week there was a question that came in, you know, how do I make a read-only style admin account?
Yeah, kind of like a Linux system or Unix system.
Right. I kind of oversimplified things, you know, where it's not really possible to do. And, you know, I thought about it some more, and yes, it is technically possible to do, but it's by no means easy. And it also might mean that you can't use some of the default tools that are built into Windows, especially the UI tools.
Yeah.
To get what you want. So you can always create custom security groups, and you can add standard users to those security groups, and that will give them additional privileges.
Mm-hmm.
So you can create a standard user that has, say, additional rights to files and reg keys that they would be able to see that they wouldn't normally be able to see if they just logged in interactively under their own account and they went to regedit, for example, or to any or to the MMC tools or the event viewer and things like that. But if you do create those kinds of security groups, you can create command line tools, PowerShell scripts, for example, that will be able to get you all of the information that you need most of the time. You know, I'm not going to say it will work 100% of the time, because there are definitely certain things where you need the administrator credential. You need very certain administrator credentials or security privileges that you wouldn't normally have as a standard user, and it would be, you know, if you assign them to the standard user, they may as well be admin already.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, I don't want to be an admin, but if you assign somebody, say, debugger privileges, right, then you can debug any application and then insert code, run code, and then that could elevate.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you are part of the backup admins group, you technically have rights to all the files on the system. You can go replace files that, when another administrator logs on, could take full access to the machine. So we give you all of these different knobs and levers that you can tweak. We tend to discourage it unless you know exactly what it is that you're going after, because one false move and you've now given a user indirect admin privileges where, you know, you wouldn't normally think that they had it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Awesome. All right, so our first question today is from Matthew, and he says, "Hey guys, the show is super awesome and honestly was the only thing that sufficiently distracted me while I was at dialysis, but don't cry for me, gurus. I've since gotten my kidney transplant December 1st, and the show now distracts me from my mundane waiting at clinic appointments. I feel like we owe him a Netflix account."
That is seriously impressive. You know, we shout out definitely goes out to you for...
Yeah.
You know, sticking through that and getting better and getting well.
I'm glad that we were able to distract you. There is a thing called Netflix that is also distracting. So, all right. So Matthew was thinking about replacing a motherboard and CPU on his Windows home server. Hardware is about 5 years old, so I was thinking replacing these components and getting a funky new case while I'm at it. Side note, this is why I rack mount everything. Otherwise, I'd be doing case mods all day, all night.
You don't want to look at your case.
No, I just rack mount it, and then I can't. I can't do case mods.
Wait, you don't like the blinky blue lights?
I like a lot of different things, but I don't want to have, like, a Death Star PC in my... I don't need to be spending time on that. I need to focus on what's on the PC, not the PC itself. But... Oh.
It's funny, when I set up all my computer equipment in a closet in my house, the first thing you do is you open the door, there's a closet. You open the door and there's just lights and fans and everything whirring, and, you know, there's blue lights, green lights, red lights. It's like, you know.
And when you get home, you just look at it, don't you?
I open the door and just look. Well, I can open the door and just quick scan of the LEDs and the pitch of the fans, and I can tell, you know, exactly what's going on. Oh, I'm, you know, recording a show now, or, you know, there's I'm recompiling something. I can tell exactly what it is that my equipment is doing just based on the lights and the sounds.
Yeah. Nice. All right, so he was a little concerned about activation on the server. Tracking down an old CPU is no problem, but the motherboard's more hard to find. What can I expect from WPA if I just replace the two most important components in the system?
So, yeah, WPA, the Windows activation technology that we have, is tied to the specific hardware. Mm-hmm. And if you change, you know, we have a heuristic that if you change certain components very frequently, or if you change a whole bunch of them all at once, activation will come back at you saying, hey, what happened? Looks like a new machine. This particular case, if you're just replacing the motherboard and CPU, you might want to take a look at your hard drive and video card, frankly, while you're at it, depending on how old things are.
Yeah.
Upgrade to an SSD. You might seriously enjoy it. If it's a server, your video card may not matter that much.
Yeah.
WPA may complain at you, but it's really not a big deal. Just phone the number if it doesn't automatically, if it doesn't let you internet reactivate again.
Yeah.
Just phone up the number and, you know, explain to the person on the phone and you'll be resolved really, really fast.
Yeah.
But if it's only those two components and you haven't done any other hardware changes, my gut instinct will say that you actually won't have an activation problem.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, shouts out to Matthew. So good luck to you. From Michael, he says, I have music ripped from CDs using Windows Media Player on a computer running Windows 7. I'd like to move those to another computer, also running Windows 7, which already has ripped CD content as well. If I simply copy the folders from the user profile's music directory, will that preserve everything, album art, metadata, etc., or will I lose some of that data? Well, copying everything in that music directory should be fine, so you won't lose anything. The metadata and album art and things like that are tied to the file specifically. They're in the file.
Well, the MP3 or the ID tags, as they say, are tied to the files. If you actually, I don't think I have any music content on my machine.
The sample music.
Sample music. Yeah, actually, so... I've got show all hidden files, and this is the album art that is associated with these MP3s.
Yeah.
So if you do, you have to make sure that you're copying everything in those folders.
Yeah.
And yes, you'll get everything. The metadata is actually tied to each file. The album art has... it's tied to the file as well, but it's only a tenuous... relationship.
Yeah.
So you'll want to copy everything. If you've ripped it with other software, I know iTunes does this, it will embed the album art in the file itself.
Yeah.
In which case you don't have to be quite as careful.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do it with Media Player, just make sure that you take all the files in the folder with it and you should be golden.
And this is why I also save my playlists. So, like, you know, I use Winamp more than I probably should, but I save my playlists in my music directory, so I always have those, and they're always just referencing that one path. They don't have to go back out of anything else.
So. It's all relative paths.
Yeah, it makes it simple, and then I just back up my music directory, and I've got it all. So there's your answer. Next question, why do emails to people have a WinDAT file attached in from Outlook in Office 2003? I got this question from a friend of mine, and I've got a link here that'll talk about it. How to prevent WinMail DAT attachments from being sent. It's an issue that if Outlook sends a message using RTF, the rich text format, then it'll include this WinMail DAT as a file attachment. And there's nothing you can do with it. You can't really, like, open it and look at it. It's not...
It's associated metadata to say how to actually read this in Outlook.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it looks like I'm attaching, or it looks like, you know, you've got a file attachment on all your emails. So the link that I'll provide in the show notes will tell you how to step through and turn this feature off so that it doesn't actually do that again. And
or you can just send an HTML.
Yes, you could do that.
Rich tech just is so 90s, man.
Yeah. All right, next question. Considering a large portion of our users are local admins and don't want to be disturbed by a UAC prompt, can you give your opinion on deploying Windows 7 with UAC disabled?
My opinion on deploying with UAC disabled is don't.
Ever.
Ever. There's always caveats to that.
Yeah.
The historic guidance has been if you're running well locked down servers, you might deploy those with UAC off because you're actually not getting any benefit from it. You're not running, you're not accessing the internet from your server. If you're running lockdown servers, you should be logging in as a standard user for any non-admin tasks that you're doing. But otherwise, you kind of have to ask yourself, why are you deploying machines where users have local admin rights to begin with? With Windows 7, the number of prompts as compared to Vista with UAC has gone dramatically down. what you can do to not turn off UAC, but still have most of the benefits of UAC and not get the prompting that some people find less than desirable, is by going to the control panel, going to user accounts, and change user account control settings, and you have this slider. The bottommost turns off UAC.
Yeah.
Move it to the first one.
Mm-hmm.
This will make it so that you don't get notifications, but well-behaved applications that are declaring themselves to be run as Invoker or run as a standard user will not get unnecessary admin privileges.
Yeah.
The things that do request admin privileges will get will essentially have the prompt auto accept for them.
Mm-hmm.
That is the end result of this particular setting.
Yeah, I guess we think a lot of UAC as being kind of binary on or off, but we do have other settings there, so.
Exactly.
It is a possibility. There you go. Awesome. Next question. When we index the content of a doc or a PDF, other files, do we need that application to be installed on the computer? So do you need, like, you know, Adobe Reader or Foxit or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Or does it matter which one you have installed for the content to be indexed?
You need something called an iFilter for the particular doc type. Now, we include certain doc types with Windows that we will index, but things like PDF, Office, certain Office docs that we don't include in Box, needs either the full application or many different applications have stripped down just filter install packages. I know Office produces one, Foxit produces one. I'm not entirely certain about Adobe whether or not they produce one or not.
Mm-hmm.
But you can install that and then you don't necessarily have to have the application. But if you do install Adobe Reader, for example, it does install an indexer for it. And it will, you know, automatically index your PDFs.
So to be on the safe side, if you install Foxit or Adobe Reader, you'd be
fine.
You'd be okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. All right. Next question. I'm getting this error when I try to play any DVD. I've searched for this and seen many other approaches for resolving. Looking for your ideas. And this is on Windows Server, but it says he's trying to play a DVD, and it says Windows Media Player cannot play the DVD because a compatible DVD decoder is not installed on your computer. So server SKUs, they don't usually have the codecs to play a DVD.
No, because it's a server, right? People
yeah.
aren't watching movies on a server, generally speaking. It doesn't have the MPEG-2 decoder installed by default. It's not installed on all SKUs. We have it currently on the home SKUs and the ultimate SKUs.
Yeah.
But in this particular case, you know, you can either get a third-party MPEG-2 decoder. You could
install VLC.
You can install VLC that has its own embedded MPEG-2 decoder. I don't have a particular preference. Probably just say, don't watch movies on a server.
Yeah.
But, you know, who knows why they're trying to do that to begin with.
Yeah.
But there are solutions. It's just the inbox, because we wanted to keep costs down for the end user.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the demand wasn't there, and we have to... there are certain accounting things that have to be done when we include codecs in different SKUs.
Yeah, people probably don't even think about that when they buy Windows, but, you know, a little portion of what you pay for Windows is... goes off to different people who have a stake in the mm-hmm. things that we include with Windows. So
we have agreements with, you know, other folks, and we're not always in control of everything.
Yeah.
Right.
You're sick? Is that the deal?
My throat, my voice is kind of going away on me.
All right. Okay, next question. I need to copy a DVD to another DVD, but I only have a single DVD drive. How can I best accomplish this? I tried copying the files of the desktop to another DVD, and it didn't work out. So it depends on what type of DVD you're mm-hmm. working with. You know, if it's just like a data DVD or something, I think the best way to do it would just be to make an ISO out of that
mm-hmm.
and then burn the ISO or even mount it. You don't even have to burn it to another disk if you don't need to. There's caveats with this, right?
Yeah, we can mention, you know, or at least step over the fact that this is a commercial movie DVD. We're really not going to answer any questions on that one.
Yeah.
If it's a data DVD, like you said, you know, just copy the files directly to the disc and recopy them back.
Yeah.
Or, you know, do it to an ISO. If this was a home movie DVD, you know, you have a camcorder and it writes out to a DVD in DVD video format.
Mm-hmm.
So it has, you know, if you open up the file, it'll have audio TS, video TS. Same idea apply. You can actually copy it to an ISO and
yeah.
recopy it back because it'll be a bit for bit
mm-hmm.
informational copy. Doing what he did with just copying audio TS and video TS, assuming that was the kind of DVD it was, doesn't actually work.
Yeah, and so if it is a protected movie DVD, that's not going to help you there.
Here there be dragons.
There's ways to do anything. You can go do a search, and you know, Bing is your friend. All right, next question. What's the best format type to have the most compatibility between Mac, PC, and Linux? So if you're formatting a hard drive and you know you're going to use it between several different systems, what's the best way to do that?
FAT32 is basically universal,
mm-hmm.
As well as XFAT. You have to install, I believe, some updates to make that work on XP and Vista. Don't quote me on it. I don't know if XP actually has XFAT support at all.
Yeah.
But FAT32 is going to be your most universally accepted format. If you just need to read data off the disk, you can use NTFS.
Yeah.
The various other operating systems have usable, readable NTFS support. I wouldn't trust any of the NTFS support that writes to the disk, though.
Yeah, so if you have like a thumb drive, you know you're going to use between a lot of different systems. Is there any downside to having it formatted as FAT32?
Not really.
Like performance or anything like that?
No, the drive itself is going to be slow.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to see any real impact of going to FAT32. In fact, it might actually be faster in a lot of cases. You'd lose some of the inherent data anti-corruption mechanisms that are inherent to NTFS, though.
Yeah. Okay, cool. All right, next question. I installed Windows 7 Ultimate on my netbook and my touchpad was working fine, but when I restarted my computer, the touchpad doesn't work anymore and the buttons don't work. Yeah, I tried reinstalling the driver and it didn't help. So yeah, this was one where it depends on what the settings were. If your touchpad worked before, though, mm-hmm. and something happened, your touchpad doesn't work again, it could be that there's a button on the touchpad. This particular laptop,
mm-hmm.
It's an HP NV17. If I touch in the upper left-hand corner of the touchpad, it turns it off.
Mm-hmm.
And in my HP TX2, there's kind of a weird little button that's down below the touchpad that if you hit that, it'll turn off the touchpad.
Mm.
So you might have turned off your touchpad and just not realized it. And it could be an area of the touchpad that you touch to turn it off, but it might also be a physical button that's on the machine, too. So you need to check that out.
The other thing to look at is, you know, if you can plug in a regular mouse and it works,
yeah,
It's potentially that the driver didn't get installed correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Go to Device Manager, look for any yellow exclamation marks. You can roll back the driver and see if you get a better inbox version, or you can try an update from Windows Update.
Yeah.
If all else fails, I don't know. I'm sure most people know about how device installation actually works, but... if you go to the Windows INF directory and you take a look at the setup API devlog, you can actually see exactly what happens during a device installation with error codes. And the thing to look for is bang, 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 or three exclamation marks.
Yeah.
If you look for that, you can quickly find errors. And if you take a look at this log, you can start to at least narrow down what are the potential issues
mm-hmm.
and look up the error codes. But, you know, if you're going to mail in questions about device installation issues that you might have, do send in this setupapi.dev.log file. That'll actually help a lot.
Cool. Awesome. All right, pick of the week time. Pick of the week. And this week's pick of the week is the how-to guide to installing and booting Windows 8 Consumer Preview off of VHD. This comes from Microsoft's own Scott Hanselman. And if you don't know Scott Hanselman, he is the Brad Pitt of Microsoft geeks. He walks you through the steps that you need to do if you want to boot from VHD.
And this is how I do all my testing.
Yeah, and explain the benefits of doing VHD instead of just flattening your machine.
Oh, VHDs are so nice. It takes very little time to set up. You don't have to set up another partition. It can be based off of a subdirectory on your existing partition, as long as you have space.
And the TLA here with VHD?
Oh, virtual hard disk.
Okay.
It makes everything nice and encapsulated. You know, so if you need to wipe and restore, you don't format, you just nuke the VHD,
mm-hmm.
right? And you can run msconfig and clean up the boot entry. But it makes self-hosting, new builds, and partitioning off the entire OS away from other OSs much, much simpler. You know, you'll have all your user data or any user-generated data in there. But it makes it so that if you want to start fresh, you just delete the VHD, create a new one, you're good to go. You don't have to worry a lot about what's going on.
Awesome. All right. And so we'll link to this. And if you want to install Windows 8, but you don't want to flatten your machine, here's a good way to do it. And this will walk you through all the steps. And so that is the show for this week. If you'd like to contact us, you can email us at defragshow@microsoft.com, or you can leave notes in the show notes. We prefer the email so we can go back and forth. And we will see you next week.
Take care.